Somewhere in the depths of the Vatican Museums, there sits a strange chair, known as a sede pertusa, or pierced seat, but more often incorrectly called a sede stercoraria, or dunghill seat. It's an ornately carved throne with a hole through it, like a toilet seat. Sources from throughout the Middle Ages and the Renaissance claim that whenever a pope was elected, the sede pertusa was used for a rather unique ritual. Once the pope had been chosen, and before he appeared on the balcony of St. Peter's to address the crowd of well-wishers outside, he would be required to sit in the sede pertusa while wearing his long papal robes, traditionally without undergarments. Speaking Latin, the language of day-to-day Vatican affairs, even today, one of the cardinals surrounding the pope-elect would ask, "Habet?" And an unlucky young cardinal would have to reach under the seat, feel up the soon-to-be Holy Father, and hopefully announce, "Duos habet, et bene pendentes." This translates as, "Does he have them?" And the response, "He has two, and they dangle well." They were quite literally checking if he had the balls to be pope.
Those are balls.
Why was this alleged ritual a thing? Why was the inspection of the papal ball sack such a big deal? I can tell you this, they weren't doing a testicular cancer PSA. And I can tell you this, they weren't trying to transplant goat glands into the scrotum of the pontiff. No, scholars at the time said the sede pertusa was installed as a ritual after the most scandalous event in the history of the papacy. That time, a woman infiltrated the ranks of the church and got all the way to being pope until she was found out. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. The most widely cited account of the woman pope comes from the writings of Martin of Opava, a 13th century monk from what's now the Czech Republic. According to him, this pope's name was Joan Anglicus, meaning from England, although Martin of Opava says she was really born in Mainz, in present-day Germany. She had become smitten with an educated clergyman who took her to Athens, disguised as a man, to study at the universities there. Still living as a man, after years of studying, she ended up in Rome, where she became a respected professor, was eventually named as a cardinal, and so charmed the other cardinals that she was named pope, taking the name John VIII. She, or maybe he, I don't know if there are any takes that depict this as a case of a trans pope, rather than a disguised woman pope, but from a modern perspective, you could definitely look at it this way. Anyway, Pope John VIII, who came to be known as Pope Joan when their true origins were unmasked, reigned as pope for 2 years, from 855 to 857 AD, until something happened that proved she was a woman all along. Now, if you know any women, this part should come as no surprise to you. You will know that women just can't stop producing babies. They'll just go around with babies dropping out of them at inopportune times. And so it was that one day, Pope John VIII was being paraded through the streets of Rome when in front of a crowd of hundreds, she went into labor, and out from under that long papal robe slid a baby. Sources aren't clear on what happened next, even between individual revisions of Martin of Opava's work, but they all agree that Joan or John Anglicus wasn't pope any longer. Some say she died then and there, in childbirth. Others that she was stoned to death by the angry crowd. Or maybe she was thrown in jail, where she lived out the rest of her days. One source also says that her illegitimate son became the Bishop of Ostia, a neighborhood in Rome, and that Joan herself survived, eventually dying a free woman after having performed enough penance for infiltrating the papacy. Dona eis requiem. Either way, they all agree that John VIII was immediately removed from the official chronology of popes, and the street where she'd dropped her cargo was declared cursed and avoided by future popes for centuries afterward. Of course, it was hard to hush this scandal up. For a long time afterward, there was no official recognition of Pope Joan from the church itself, but any European who was learned enough from about 1100 to 1600 AD knew this story. There were occasional slip-ups where the church acknowledged Joan's existence. Among the hundreds of busts of previous popes at the Duomo of Siena, there was one of a woman, until it was ordered destroyed in 1601 by then-Pope Clement VIII. And by then, the Protestant Reformation was already in full swing. Some reformers had seized on the story of Pope Joan as evidence that the papacy was unnecessary. The Czech dissident Jan Hus famously claimed in 1415 that clearly, if a woman ascended to be pope and did reasonably well, anybody could be pope, and therefore the papacy was a worthless figurehead title and the church would be better run by a council of cardinals. Reformers also spread the story of Joan as evidence that the popes weren't an unbroken line going back to St. Peter, since a woman had been pope, polluting the line of succession. There were even a few people, even in those days, who saw her as a feminist figure. Writing in 1440, the French clergyman Martin Lefranc says that while, yes, it was bad that she let herself get elected pope without revealing her gender, Joan was a fair and well-read leader who didn't debase the office of pope as much as some other more corrupt popes around her era did, and the world would do well to have more women like Joan. On the other end of the spectrum, there were pamphlets that seized on the existence of the Sede Pertusa as evidence that the Catholic Church were a bunch of perverts. Hey, have you heard that they ritually touch the Pope's balls? That's fucked up, right? It was also around the time of the Reformation that the first doubts around the Pope Joan story began to arise, mostly from Catholics attempting to defend the Church against its new critics. The first attempt at claiming Pope Joan never existed was written by Florimond de Raymond, a Catholic magistrate from Bordeaux, France, my former hometown, in 1587. In addition to the Reformation, humanism was sweeping through Europe, an intellectual movement that aimed to promote a more human-centered view of the universe rather than a God-centered one, and one that was accompanied by leaps forward in arts, philosophy, science, and engineering. The Renaissance had arrived. Credulously believing anything an old monk had written way back when was falling out of style, even if it was something that was common knowledge and everyone knew was true, like the story of Pope Joan. Applying new standards of textual analysis to the Pope Joan story, Florimond de Raymond found a few pretty obvious holes. For one thing, Pope John VIII, the name said to have been used by Pope Joan, was a real pope, who reigned from 872 to 882 and left a fairly distinguished legacy, unlike most popes from around then. Nobody ever claimed that he was secretly a woman. As for the period when Pope Joan was said to have been in charge, 855 to 857, there was a real pope during that period, Benedict III. There isn't much record of who Benedict III was and what he did, but he was Italian, and there were no contemporary reports that he may have been a woman in drag. Some Protestants, intent on discrediting the church with the Pope Joan story, claimed that Florimond had actually proved that Pope Joan was real, by proving a cover-up, scrubbing her from the historical record. Protestants alleged that the real reason there wasn't much information about Benedict III is that he didn't exist, and the real pope during that time was Pope Joan. Oh, and about that numbering of popes named John, didn't Pope John the 21st take office at a time when, according to the official chronology, there had only been 19 popes named John? Didn't he skip over Pope John the 20th, claiming that whatever the record said, there had already been 20 Pope Johns? That sure is fishy, isn't it? Who's that missing Pope John? Turns out, though, It was because of a mistake surrounding Pope John the 14th. John the 14th had a very short papacy. 8 months into his reign, he was imprisoned by a guy calling himself Boniface the 8th, one of the many anti-popes who you will meet over the course of this episode. That is, people who claimed to be pope at the time, but the modern Catholic Church says weren't. John the 14th died under unclear circumstances, 4 months into jail, and historians weren't sure whether to count the months he had spent in jail as time when he had been pope. So, when the 20th pope to take the name John looked at the list of previous popes, what he saw was John, 8 months, followed by John, imprisoned, 4 months, on separate lines, and assumed they were two separate people. As a result, he skipped number 20 and declared himself John the 21st. So, Pope John the 20th does not exist, and that has nothing to do with Pope Joan. And the strongest bit of evidence against the existence of Pope Joan was that none of the accounts of her rise and fall come from close to when Joan supposedly reigned, and the further back they go, the less they agree on anything. The earliest known writing on Joan came from some other random monk in the early 13th century, not long before Martin of Opava made the story famous. This other monk set Pope Joan's reign in 1099, over 200 years after everyone else said it had happened. All of the early accounts seem to be written in a much more skeptical or uncertain tone, you know, many people are saying. Now, whether Joan was pope in 855 or 1099, even if the Catholic Church had done everything they could to suppress the story, it would have gotten out sooner or later. The public wouldn't suddenly become aware of it hundreds of years later. The pope had enemies back then. The church itself was largely unquestioned, but the pope wasn't. He was equal parts a spiritual leader and a political leader. You could disagree with him, and plenty of noble families across Europe did, many of whom wanted to place a pope from their own house on the throne. The pope had a lot of power and influence, but he wasn't the only person with power and influence. If something so scandalous as the pope giving birth in front of a crowd of people had happened, all Europe would have known within months. And the story had always been a little bit weird. Childbirth isn't something that just happens like that. Pope Joan would have known for months that she was pregnant, and for hours that she was about to have a baby. The Pope's inner circle would probably have guessed what was going on already, given that it would be impossible to ignore the Pope's belly swelling, and if some of the cardinals knew she was a woman before she joined that parade, why didn't they just remove her from office behind the scenes and claim the Pope had an unfortunate accident? If Joan had delivered a baby in front of crowds, she would probably already have been in labor for hours, and she'd have known exactly what was happening early enough to cancel the parade. And if she suddenly knew she was about to have a baby midway through the parade, say her water broke in front of crowds, although she'd probably be aware even before that, she could equally have discreetly told her aides that something had gone wrong and she had to get back to the palace immediately. And you could just say whatever in historical sources back then. Petrarch claimed that after Pope Joan was found out, it rained blood in Brescia for 3 days. That's easy enough to reject without hearing anything else, so maybe we should have treated the whole rest of the story the same way. The one big asterisk is the sede pertusa, the ball-squeezing chair. The sede pertusa, or as it's more often referred to in the historical literature, the sede stercoraria, really existed, and there are accounts of it really being used in a ritual when a new pope took office, until about the 16th century. Exactly what that ritual involved, other than the pope sitting down on an ornate chair with a big hole in it, is unknown, but people have their theories, and they're all really dumb. In addition to the rumor that it was used to make sure the new pope was a man, theories that actual reasonable people who know their shit about Catholic history have proposed as the purpose of the sede pertusa include, number one, the seat had originally been built as a toilet, and the new pope sitting on it was a humiliation ritual used to show that he was not a god, he was just a man, and he was bound by earthly needs like everyone else. Number two, it really was to check if the pope had balls, but because there was a heretical minor sect in early Christianity that practiced self-castration, and as a result, eunuchs have been prohibited from becoming pope ever since. And three, The seat was originally built as a birthing chair for Roman noblewomen and therefore was a symbol of the Mother Church. It probably wasn't used to make sure the Pope was a man, and most likely wasn't used for any of those three purposes either, but that rumor was well known and well documented even by the 15th century, and it's conceivable that at some point the ball check ritual really was performed, because for a few centuries, the myth of Pope Joan was widely believed even within the church itself. The Pope had begun to recognize that Joan never existed by around 1600, but it wasn't until a dissertation on Pope Joan by the French Protestant scholar David Blondel in 1647 that Protestants began to agree the whole thing was made up. Joan continued to appear in anti-Catholic polemics up until the 19th century and occasionally crops up even today as a true story, most recently on the British quiz show QI, in which the venerable, well-educated host Stephen Fry unquestioningly presented it as fact.
And the cardinals, this still happens to this day, when the Pope is crowned, the cardinals, the Pope is carried on a chair over the cardinals, and they look up and they say, testiculus habet et bene pendentes.
No. This
is, yes, it is
he
absolutely
has balls
true.
That he's well hung.
No.
Bene pendentes.
It means that they are well hung. They are hanging well. And it goes back to the time of Pope Joan, when a girl masqueraded as a young Pope. And since that's when the ceremony was introduced, and so the tradition continues to this day.
Fabulous, 5 points, brilliant, I love it.
In fact, today, Pope Joan has experienced a revival in interest. We all want to believe there was a woman pope, don't we? There was a movie about her in 2009, which attracted criticism from Catholic newspapers for spreading the myth, and criticism from all other newspapers for being pretty mid. She may have been the inspiration for the High Priestess tarot card. And in probably the weirdest portrayal of Pope Joan in pop culture, Persona 5 features a character that has been described to me as Pope Joan as an anthropomorphic motorcycle. I gotta play the Persona games, I never have. So, where did the myth of Pope Joan come from? When some random monk suggested there had been a woman pope at one point, why did all of Europe go, "Yeah, I bet that happened"? Well, for one thing, in the 13th century, when the Pope Joan myth was first being spread around, the role of women in the church was a hot-button issue. Plenty of monastic orders were being forced to turn away nuns who wanted to follow the same customs as their order, and in response, women were founding their own lay orders. Most people writing about Joan said she came from Germany, which makes sense, because Germany was a hotbed of medieval Catholic proto-feminism. In the 13th century, so-called Beguines, women who sought a closer connection with God without the church standing in their way, formed intentional communities across what's now Germany and the Alps. Cologne alone had 97 Beguine convents, unsanctioned by the church. Before then, a woman's path in medieval Germany was either be a wife or be a nun, both of which were awfully restrictive. Now, you could be a Beguine instead. And understandably, clergymen weren't too keen on the Beguines. They were practicing Christianity without engaging with the church structure. They weren't seen as heretics because, fundamentally, the Beguines were still Catholic. But they were uncomfortably free. Not long before the emergence of the Pope Joan myth, Pope Innocent III complained that in some places, women were preaching in churches, and male monasteries were accepting women into their orders. It makes sense that around this time, people may have been sniffing, "Where does this end? With a woman becoming Pope?" Others say the Pope Joan myth evolved out of stories of the corrupt Pope John XII, who had reigned between 955 and 964, and is known even today as one of the cruelest and horniest popes of all time. It's said that under his reign, the Vatican was one big brothel. He literally tortured his cardinals for the slightest infractions, held orgies in the Apostolic Palace, and is said to have had a mistress named Joan, who might have been the subject of jokes around the time about how she was really the one in charge. It's possible that originally there was a rumor about Joan giving birth in a public place, and the original way that was scandalous was that it was the Pope's baby. Only over time did it change, and the story became that Joan herself was the Pope. Or Maybe. Since Pope Joan is said to have styled herself as Pope John VIII, it was an attack on the real Pope John VIII, who had been attacked by his opponents as a weak, effeminate leader for allowing the thawing of relations between the Pope and the Patriarch of Constantinople. So now, these monks chronicling papal history were having the last laugh by portraying him as a literal disguised woman. Oh, and you know what? There really was a woman pope. Today, the Pope is chosen in a process known as a papal conclave, which comes from the Latin phrase cumclave, which isn't funny. Okay, maybe it's a little funny. Cumclave, in turn, means with a key, and it means that the cardinals get locked in the Sistine Chapel with a key and can't come out until they've elected a pope. The pope will need to be chosen from the cardinals in the conclave, but you can't run for pope. Someone else has to suggest your name first, and it's considered bad form to advocate either for or against your own selection as pope. Cardinals discuss, then they put in their ballots, and they keep voting until one candidate gets a two-thirds majority. If the conclave drags on for a few days, the lowest vote-getters will start getting eliminated to narrow down the field of candidates, but it's rare for a conclave to last that long. When they've decided on a pope, the cardinals traditionally burn their ballots in the Sistine Chapel fireplace, making white smoke come out of the chimney, which is famously the first signal that a new pope has been elected. Today, to make sure the color comes out right, they add chemicals to the fire. The conclave seems as old as the church itself, but it's not. It's old, sure. The first conclaves happened in the 1200s, but by then, the papacy was already almost 1,000 years old, and the system of having cardinals alone elect the pope was first created in 1059. Before then, who elected the pope depended on who had political control over Rome at the time. After all, for most of its history, the papacy was every bit as much a political office as it was a religious one. Sometimes the pope was arguably more important as a secular leader. He was the bishop of Rome, but for a lot of Rome's history, he was also effectively the king of Rome and the surrounding area. This is why, even pre-Reformation, the pope had a lot of haters, who would definitely have seized on a scandal like Pope Joan. Criticizing the pope didn't necessarily mean criticizing God. It meant criticizing whatever enemy of yours put that pope on the throne. Plenty of kings said they ruled by divine right. The pope was no different. For a period from the mid-8th century to the end of the 9th, that is, incorporating the period when Pope Joan is said to have had her brief reign, the Frankish kings, Charlemagne and his descendants, had the most control over the papacy. But then, not long after that, the Frankish Empire's control over Italy weakened, and the papacy fell into the control of shrewd local aristocrats around Rome, bringing it into a dark age. Literally, in the history of the Catholic Church, this period is usually called the Seculum Obscurum, Dark Age. The Seculum Obscurum is also almost as commonly known by another delightfully colorful, very unpapal-sounding name, the Pornocracy. Which is super fun to say, but also somewhat sexist, because this period wouldn't have had that nickname if it had just been a period of men behaving badly. No, the pornocracy, the nadir of the Catholic Church, was also the apex of women's power over the church. One woman in particular. In the year 904, Pope Sergius III took control of the Vatican with the protection of his uncle, Count Theophylact of Tusculum, best described as a local warlord. There are rumors that Theophylact set Sergius up with his daughter, Sergius's cousin Marozia of Tusculum, when the pope was in his 40s and Marozia was a teenager. This is usually seen as a myth, but either way, Marozia grew up tough, mean, seductive, and the ancestor of more popes than any other individual. When Theophylact died, Marozia became the unquestioned leader of Rome. Pope Sergius was a doormat. Marozia styled herself as senatrix, which is the female form of senator, and a word that really needs to be revived. Like swag and gnarly. The Roman Senate was a thing of the past by this point, and Marozia was just using senatrix as a powerful-sounding title, but she was, effectively, something bigger than that. Pope. The last semi-independent pope during Marozia's rule was John X, who reigned from 914 to 928, when Morozha turned on him because of the alliances he was making, threw him in jail, and smothered him to death for good measure. The next several popes were either Morozha's sons, who she had via her marriages with minor regional aristocrats, or Morozha's lovers, who fucked their way to the top. Now that's a papal conclave. When Morozha wanted to forge an alliance with some other leader through marriage, but he was already married, she would just make him get divorced, whether he wanted to or not. Secular leaders didn't have the power to cancel marriages, only the Pope had that power. Morozha used the powers afforded to her like a buffet. She wasn't devoutly religious, so she didn't issue any real reforms to the church. She didn't name a lot of new cardinals or preside over religious services, and neither did the figurehead official popes she appointed, but she did use and abuse her spiritual power. But the trouble with marrying feuding local lords, making them happy by having successors, then dumping them once you've gotten into their good graces and moving on to another local lord, is that eventually, some of your children from a previous marriage might get mad to see you canoodling their regional rival. And that's exactly what happened to Morozha. After decades of juggling alliances and wrapping the Catholic leadership around her little finger, she was overthrown and tossed in jail by her son Alberic II of Spoleto, where she died after 5 years, at the age of only 47. But Morozha's legacy didn't die with her. Four more popes were the direct descendants of Morozha, and they were among the wickedest popes to ever set up shop in Rome. The aforementioned Pope John XII, Pope Benedict VIII, who was actually a reformer for his time and wasn't that bad, Pope John XIX, under whose watch the Eastern Schism happened, creating an Eastern Orthodox Church separate from the Catholic Church for the first time, Pope Benedict IX, the only pope to have ever sold the office, and for good measure, Pope Benedict X, who is generally not considered a legitimate pope. But if there's one thing I've found researching this episode is that there are long periods in history where it wasn't clear who was pope. There are popes who were enthroned in Rome, widely and uncontroversially considered pope during their reign, who got delisted as popes centuries later, when the church seemingly arbitrarily said, "Wait, this other guy who said he was pope was the real pope during this time. This one, who we considered pope up to this point, was actually an anti-pope." Ultimately, the era of Morozha, the Seculum Obscurum, the papocracy if you want to call it that, cast a long shadow on the Catholic Church. Longer even than the descendants of Morozha who were elevated to the papacy. It ended up codifying what it meant to be pope. The Gregorian reform period, which was a reaction to the corruption of the papacy, was the beginning of the modern understanding of the papacy. It was still a political office, and it still is today. Being pope makes you head of state of the Vatican, the world's smallest country. But it was first and foremost a religious office. Morozha had turned the papacy into her local fiefdom, scrubbing it clean of almost all its religious trappings. After her family's hold on power slipped, it was set into church law that the pope's spiritual authority was the most important. Having lands you ruled over as pope was just a perk of the office. The election process by the cardinals was created to make sure this system would stay in place, and the locking of the cardinals into a room, cumclave, was later added to the rules so that the cardinals wouldn't take years of arguing to choose a pope, which happened a few times. The age of secular nobles choosing the pope was over. It is said that the papacy is the longest lasting office in the world, and it may be the longest lasting title in the world, but being pope meant something very different earlier in the church's history. By the time Martin of Opava made the Christian world believe in the legend of Joan, the idea of a woman controlling the papacy had become appropriately scandalous. And so, the story of the woman who made herself pope is a lot more complicated than the one that medieval Europeans believed. It's easy to adapt Joan's story into a modern feminist fable, which a lot of people have done over the years. It's fun to believe that there was a medieval woman so educated, so skilled in so many ways, that she tricked her way into being pope. A lot of people, even at the time the Pope Joan legend was believed, admired her for that. By today's standards, the morals of the Pope Joan story are black and white. A wise and brave woman found a way through the misogyny of her time and prospered, until she was found out by accident and the bad guys won. Morozha is not exactly a role model. She gaslit local noblemen, gatekept the seat of the Holy Father, and girl-bossed her way through Rome. She was you know, bad. She had most of her enemies tortured to death. She sold off her own family members as mistresses for European royals to keep them on her good side. And no matter how religious you are, you have to admit that turning the office of Pope into something of a regional warlord surrounded by a harem of concubines is a bit of a dick move. Marozia is basically a picture-perfect medieval caricature of an evil seductress. Should we celebrate Marozia? That's a thorny question, but we should know about her. When I first heard about Pope Joan, it was told to me as fact, and I was disappointed to discover that it wasn't. It took me a lot longer to discover that there was a true story of a woman pope, and it was way, way more interesting. You know what? Pour one out for Marozia. She was cruel, but she was a medieval noblewoman in the ruins of the Frankish Empire. In her milieu, might made right. You were either a cruel leader or a good peasant. So kudos to Marozia for using everything she had in her sexist world to get ahead and show the men just how bad she could be. So yes, once upon a time, a woman really did girl boss so hard that she became Pope. But she was no meek, studious biggin. She had some serious balls, and they dangled well.